We're going to be studying from the third chapter of the book of Daniel, so you do have your Bibles and you might be looking there. And we're going to be reading some scripture there from Daniel chapter 3. We saw in the last lesson the dream of Nebuchadnezzar about a great metallic man. We saw Daniel's interpretation of the dream and, of course, the fact that he and his companions were exalted to very high position in the kingdom of Babylon after that Daniel had made known to the king the dream and the interpretation thereof. Before we start our study of chapter 3, the first section, which is verse 1 to 7, the image of gold, we want to make a few interesting points about this chapter. And I've listed five here in our lesson. They come from the overall lesson itself, and not all of them are borne out in today's lesson, but will come out in a later lesson. First of all, I would say that here we see the remarkable courage and faith of Daniel's three companions, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Now, the remarkable thing is that Daniel, who had done all the thinking up until this time, it would seem, Daniel was not present at the time of the trial of chapter 3. Somebody said, well, where was Daniel? I don't know. He wasn't there to help them make their decision as to not worshiping the idol of the king. He could have been sick and in bed. Or more probable, he was probably away on business for the king, being the chief wise man of Babylon. So I would assume that he was away on business for the king, though the Bible does not say where he was or why he was gone. Those two things are the most probable reasons for his absence. Now, the second observation that I make is that the time of the event of chapter 3 is uncertain. You say, well, now, when did it happen? We don't know. The chronology was given in chapter 2, but it's not given here. Now, we know that it had to be after the three Hebrews had been exalted to their position of taking care of the province of Babylon because of what's said in verse 12. But how long after that, we do not know. It could have been 2, 3 years, or some say it could have been as much as 23 years. I don't know. I think 23 is a little far-fetched. I would be more inclined to believe that it was 2, maybe 3 years, something like that. Long enough time that the king forgot about Daniel's God being a God of gods and a king of kings. And he began to think more about the things of Babylon, seemingly forgot the statement that he made there in the latter part of chapter 2. So we don't know how long. I just conjecture that it was 2 or 3 years after the events in chapter 2. That's the best I could say. Now, number 3, by primary interpretation, the experience of these Hebrew youths teach God's care for his captive people, Israel, in the days of Nebuchadnezzar the king. Now, that is from the primary interpretation. But then, fourthly, by application, the story teaches us that God always cares for his own when they stand for truth. So I told you there the primary meaning. Then I have given you now the practical application. As oftentimes I have said, there is also the prophetic revelation. That's certainly true here. By prophetic revelation, we have a picture of Israel in the tribulation when the Antichrist rules the world. And if you don't believe it is a picture, then read the 13th chapter of Revelation, chapter 13, verse 6 and 7, verse 12 to 15. And what is remarkable when we read Revelation 13 and compare it with Daniel chapter 2 and chapter 3, we find that the times of the Gentiles started out with an image, the golden image of Nebuchadnezzar in our lesson today. But in Revelation 13, the times of the Gentiles will end with another image that's set up by Antichrist in a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. So in substance, I'm saying that the times of the Gentiles begins with an image, and it ends with an image. It ends up as it begins, with an image. And for many years, I read the Bible, and that never struck me until I compared Revelation 13 with Daniel 2 and Daniel 3. Well, so much for these preliminary remarks. We wish now to go into the exposition of the Scripture itself. In the third chapter of Daniel, verse 1 to 7 speaks of the image of gold that the king built and put up at the plains of Dura. And so we're going to read about that. And in verse 1, we have the actual construction of the image. The question might be raised, why did the king build this great image of gold? Perhaps the dream that he had of this metallic man prompted him to build this great image of gold. Now, he did not build his image exactly like the dream. Only the head was of gold in the dream. But he makes the entire man now gold, as if somehow to symbolize him and his kingdom that he saw in the dream was the head of gold. So the building of the image was perhaps prompted by the dream of King Nebuchadnezzar. We do not know, but I would conjecture that from what we have in verse 1. Nebuchadnezzar the king made an image of gold, whose height was 70 cubits, and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. He set it up in the plains of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Now that is the province over which Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were in charge. Bear that in mind. Just a point that I wish to stress. Now, it says in our text, he made an image. In the Hebrew, the language is far more suggestive. It suggests that he made the image in the form of a man and not the form of a beast. So then he built, in a sense, an image of himself. I don't know. I suppose it might have even resembled him. Maybe that's the way it was constructed. I would just gather that it probably was. So it means a human form rather than merely just a great pillar or a great image of some sort. Now it's said to be of gold. You remember back in chapter 2 that gold was the metal that symbolized the kingdom of Babylon. So Nebuchadnezzar has built the image out of the gold that symbolizes his kingdom. Now somebody said, now was this image of solid gold or was it overlaid with gold? We do not know. The Bible merely says gold. But if according to the true fashion of that time, it was probably overlaid with gold and the wood or something else made up the rest of the structure. I'll show you that was the custom in that day. If you look in Isaiah 41 in verse 7. So the carpenter encouraged the goldsmith. See how they're working together? And he that smothereth with the hammer him that smote the anvil, saying, it is ready for the soldering. And he fastened it with nails that it should not be moved. And so you can read there, Jeremiah 30, or rather chapter 10, verse 3 to 9. Also in Isaiah 40, verse 19. You'll find out that they build these out of wood. In other words, they made the form like. And then they overlaid that with gold. Now, the reason that I'm inclined to believe that it probably was constructed that way is because when you think about the height and the breadth of it, it would scarcely have been possible maybe in that day to have obtained that much gold. So, well, how much was it? Well, he gives the dimensions there. 70 cubits. 70, of course, is 60. So it was 60 cubits. Now you say, well, how high was that? 90 feet. 90 feet high. That's a lot of gold. After all, who would have been able of lifting that much gold and putting it up? You ever thought about that? Been quite a mathematical problem. It was 9 feet then broad. So think about a great statue, as we'd call it today, that was 9 feet across and 90 feet tall. Quite a structure. I can imagine that when the sun would reflect upon this and shine upon it, that it would just be dazzling there with such a beauty that it would almost have attracted a man's sight from miles and miles away if he were looking upon it in the blazing sun at noontime. Now what is to be noted there is, let's note something here. Let's do a little counting now. All right, the height is 70 cubits, 6, 0, right? All right, let's keep counting now. and the breadth thereof 6 cubits. So there we have a 6. So we put those numbers together, we have 606. Or if we take the only two that means anything, we have 666. But in Revelation chapter 13 and verse 18, the number of the beast is 666. One more is added. But what I'm showing you is, here is a foreview of the image of Antichrist. And the very number 66 is connected with it. Whereas later in the final stage, another 6 is added. 3 sixes for the satanic trinity. The anti-God, the anti-Christ, the anti-Holy Spirit, called the false prophet in the book of Revelation. But it's significant that the two numbers 6 occur here in this construction of the image there on the plains of Dura. Now it speaks there about he set it up in the plain of Dura, in the province of Babylon. Now, I'm not absolutely sure where that was by looking at the map, nor other scholars of the Bible. There's a place, though, about 6 miles from Babylon that's called the Mounds of Dura. The archaeologists still call it that today. It's sometimes called Tola. Tola Dura is the name of the modern archaeologist for this place. Now, it's about 12 miles south-southeast of Hilla. It's near the place where the river of Dura runs. And that river, at that point, empties into the Euphrates, some 6 miles south of the ancient city of Babylon, where the kingdom and palace was. So I'm inclined to believe that this is more than likely the place where this image was built, about 6 miles from Babylon there, near the Dura River on that great plain there in the river valley-like. Now, an archaeologist named Julius Opert stated that he found on one of the 3 mounds a large brick square, 45 feet high, which he believes was the foundation of the very image of Nebuchadnezzar. Very possibly may be. We can't make too much, though, out of this Dura, because it was a common name in Mesopotamia, and oftentimes it was applied to any place that was enclosed by walls or by mountains or anything like that. So we cannot be absolutely certain of the place. The archaeologists would more than likely say this is the place there in that river valley where the river Dura runs into the Euphrates. That is where the great image was built, where all the people could have assembled. An excellent almost amphitheater there in that particular spot. So I would say that's probably the place. And as you might suppose, when he built the image, he had a dedication for it. And that's what we have in verse 2 and 3. Then Nebuchadnezzar the king sent together the princes, and I'm going to identify some of these. We got the representatives of all the nations meeting there. And they're coming out there to deify man, not to revere God, but to deify man, the king especially. Talks about the princes, that's the satraps. That word is of Persian loan, and it means protectors of the realm. And then he says, the governors, that's superintendents, are prefect. And the captains, that's one that's assigned a certain region of the empire. The judges, that's the chief arbitrators. The treasurers, that word is of Aryan origin, and it means masters of the treasury. And of course, our version has it right. It's the treasurers. The counselors, we call them today lawyers, or guardians of the law, as they called them in Babylon. The sheriffs, and that was one who gave a just sentence. He was more of a minor judge than he was really a man that went out and executed the law. It was a title of what we call today probably something like the justice of the peace. But it was nevertheless an officer in the kingdom of Babylon. And then he adds, and all the rulers of the provinces to come to the dedication of the image which Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. Then the princes, the governors and captains, the judges, the treasurers, the counselors, the sheriffs, and all the rulers of the provinces were gathered together unto the dedication of the image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up. And they stood before the image that Nebuchadnezzar had set up. So now they've all gathered there. Everybody's come to pay homage to the image of Nebuchadnezzar. At a future day, they will all come to pay homage to the homage at least to the image of the Antichrist. And here's what's going to happen. It's in a foreview here. And so a herald goes forth. A herald in that day was a man who was paid to go out and say what the king told him to say. He would compare to a paid preacher today who tells people what they want to hear. That's about what he was. Then a herald cried aloud, "To you it is commanded." In other words, it's the law of the land. Nothing you can do about it. "To you it is commanded, O people, nations, and languages, that at what time you hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king hath set up." All the great musical instruments of Babylon are mentioned there in connection with the setting up of this image and the worship. I'd say that they had probably the best orchestra in the land there to play for it. Had all the fine musicians of all the kingdom of Babylon there to play at the dedication of this image there in the plains. And so let's read on now. "And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace." From all that follows here, this furnace was nearby and the fire is burning. While the people are there, they can see it. They know if they don't worship, they're going to be thrown in the fire. "And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth shall the same hour be cast in the midst of a burning fiery furnace. Therefore at that time when all the people heard the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and all kinds of music, all the people, the nations, and the languages fell down and worshiped the golden image that Nebuchadnezzar the king had set up." So it looks like now that there's almost universal worship of the image of Nebuchadnezzar. One day there will be almost universal worship of the image of Antichrist in a rebuilt temple in Jerusalem. And so there we have it. Now let's look at a few facts here. As the orchestra would begin to play, at that precise moment, everybody was to bow down. Can you imagine what a sight that must have been? A whole valley of people, representatives from all over the world of that day. Whenever the orchestra would sound, everybody bowed down before the image. Can you imagine what it would look like if a few stiff back fellows wouldn't bow down? And thousands out here, people bowing down, but three old boys standing out there just as erect as they ever stood before. Well, that's what's going to happen. So, if a fellow didn't fall down, it meant that he would be burned to death in the furnace. It's the law of the land. If you didn't obey the law, you'd be executed. Now, that would test a man's religion pretty quick, wouldn't it? I wonder how many of us today would be able to meet the test. Now, why is it, do you suppose, that they used the orchestra? Why did they have music here? Is not music one of the heavenly gifts of God to man? The angels sang. We sing in our churches praise to God. Singing is one of the heavenly gifts of God. But sometimes it's prostituted by the devil. This was devil music. And any time that there's evil working in the hearts of men, there'll always be the devil music to accompany that. You can go out into the darkest jungles of Africa where they beat the drums and they have voodoo and all of this other black magic. And you'll find that to all of these dark deeds, that they always have the devil music to go with it. And what the sad thing is that we have that music in our generation. We have various titles for it, rock and roll, different names, but it all amounts to the same thing. It's the same beat, it's the same rhythm that they have to the tum-tums in Africa where they worship demons and devils. So what we have here is the desecration of God's magic. Music is God's magic, but here it's desecrated. And it's been prostituted and turned into a tool in the hands of the devil. Well, now there's some fellows that had awful stiff backs that day. They were pretty young men, maybe about 20 years old by this time. But they had awful stiff backs. They just would not bow down. No matter if everybody else did, they just were too hard-headed to do it. Maybe they would have been called radicals and hardheads and extremists, and I don't know what all they may have called them. But anyway, they refused to worship. And that's what we see there in verse 8 down to 18. So let's start our reading now at verse 8. Probably we'll just go all the way down to verse 12, because there are people, Chaldeans by name, that inform the king that there are three fellows that won't bow down when the orchestra plays. Wherefore, at that time, certain Chaldeans came near and accused the Jews. Bear in mind, the Chaldeans are the native people of Babylon. They are accusing foreigners that are Jews. You know the way they say that, sound like they didn't think too much of them. They spake and said to the king Nebuchadnezzar, O king, live forever. Thou, O king, hast made a decree that every man that shall hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music shall fall down and worship the golden image. I don't know why they had to tell the king what he'd done. He surely knew, but that's what they're saying. They're reminding him of what he's done. They want to get rid of these Jews, you see. And whoso falleth not down and worshipeth, that he should be cast into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews. Now look how he keeps using that word Jews. He just keeps driving that down. We got a lot of people today that worship the devil, and a lot of people today that just don't like Jews, whether they worship the devil or not. But bear in mind that the enemies of the Jews are usually the enemies of God. That's what it was here. I'm not going to be the enemy of the Jews. I'll get myself in trouble with God right quick. But they don't like the Jews in Babylon. These Chaldeans don't. There are certain Jews whom thou hast set over the affairs of the province of Babylon. Sound as if they're telling the king here that he made a mistake, which may not have gone over too well with him. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. These men, O king, have not regarded thee. Now, was that entirely the truth? No, it wasn't. These men had loyally served the king. They just weren't going to worship his idol. But now they've overstated the case, hadn't they? Have not regarded thee. Well, they had regarded the king in times past. Now, they want it to sound good, so they kind of add a little touch, you know. Say, these boys, they not only don't obey the law of the land, they don't have any use for you, the king. Of course, when Nebuchadnezzar repeats the charge, he leaves out that statement there because he knows that's not true. O king, these men, O king, have no regard. Have not regarded thee. They serve not thy gods. Now that was true. Nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. That was true. All of that was true. So now the Chaldeans are accusing the Jews of disobedience, not being good citizens of the province of Babylon. And the implication is that the nationalities of these three individuals was held against them. After all, they are foreigners, they are captives, they are Jews, they don't like the king, and they don't like the law of the land. What are you going to do about it now? You suppose these fellows might have been a little jealous because they didn't have the positions that these men had in the province of Babylon? You suppose they might have reasoned and said, now look, he couldn't take any of us. He got these young bucks here, these foreigners, this bunch of Jews, and he put them in charge of this whole province. And he left us out. And after all, we went to that same school and we were just as smart as they were, even though we didn't score as high on the test when they gave it. I can imagine that's about the way they were. And I would also assume that these men are the priests of the Babylonian religion. They're Chaldeans, and therefore, no doubt they're the priests. After all, it involved worship, and these people weren't going through with the proper worship, so it probably was the Jews that were accused here by the priest of Baal-Merodach, who were the priests of Babylon in that day. Now, as I look over that, I see a little observation. The world, the unsaved world, has true believers under surveillance. Did you know that? They have you under surveillance. They watch what you do. They listen to what you say. They've got you under surveillance. I would also observe that evil men who hold to a false religion deeply hate those who hold to true religion. What? The one that was born to the flesh persecuted him that was born to the Spirit. Back behind all persecution, in many cases, is false religion. True religion does not ever persecute. So, in a sense, the very persecution of these men was paying tribute to the deep and great religious convictions that these men had. So, in a sense, when the world persecutes us, in a sense, they're dignifying our religion. So, when you think of it from that standpoint, maybe you won't mind to receive it so bad. They're paying homage to your God and you. When they're so disgusted that they must rise up and try to do something to harm you as one of God's people. Now, there are a few other things that we mentioned here. And that is, we ought to thank God for men who will not give in to what others do and are doing. Who will always be governed by the principle of what is right and what is wrong, and not by what the multitude of people are doing. The Bible said, "Thou shalt not follow a multitude to do evil," in the book of Exodus. God's people must be different. We're to be God's peculiar people. They were here. They were separate. They came out from among the world and proved that they were indeed God's people. So now the king's mad. You might guess as much. He's uptight about it. He's hot about it. Because these fellows have really stirred him up. Well, I can just imagine that the old king was pretty well hot and bothered, we'll say, at this time. And so we find out the rage of the king in verse 13 to 15. Then Nebuchadnezzar, in his rage and fear, he's really mad, see, commanded to bring Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Go out there and get them. Bring them in. I'm sure these priests couldn't wait to do it, too. They probably had the handcuffs ready, as we'd say. Then they brought these men before the king. Bear in mind now, they are the administrators of the province of Babylon. Very prominent political men. You say, well, if they knew what was going to happen out there, why in the world did they go down there in the first place? Why didn't they play off sick? Well, I guess they could. But you know, their duties as ministers of Babylon required that they be there. It may have been they didn't know why. Maybe the king didn't tell them. They just said, go down there. We want all the government people to be down there. All these people in Babylon, you got to go down, you know. We're going to have a great important political meeting. Maybe they didn't know what they were down there for. I don't know. I've often wondered about that, if they really knew what was ahead of them. And they went anyway. Well, whatever the case was, they're there. And they're going to stand up for what they believe, regardless of the consequence. Thank God for men like that, that's willing to buck the crowd, to go through the wilderness, and to suffer for what they really do believe God to require of His people. And so he's in a rage now. The men are before him. Nebuchadnezzar spake and said unto them, is it true? Is it true? And some would translate it is true, because evidently he may already believe it. But at this point, it sounds like a question. Maybe that's what it was. Is it true, O Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego? Do not ye worship my gods, nor worship the golden image which I set up? Sounds as if he was a little bit reluctant to receive the testimony of the priest of Babylon. And so he brings them before him, and he said, is it so? He said, this is what I've been told. This is what I've heard. This message came to me. I want to know if it's so. Is it really so? Now, if ye be ready, that at what time ye hear the sound of the cornet, flute, harp, sackbut, psaltery, and dulcimer, and all kinds of music, ye fall down and worship the image which I have made, well, in other words, I'll forget it, boys. I won't hold it against you. There'll be no action taken. You can go right on, and you can be the ministers of the province of Babylon. You can keep your position in the government, and we'll forget all about it, and you won't have to go in the fire furnace. See, well, he's giving them a second chance. Yeah, giving them a second chance. You'd call it that. In other words, he said, now, I don't know. Maybe this wasn't true that I heard. So we're going to have the orchestra to play again. This time, I'm going to watch. And you better bow down. And if you don't, you're going to be in trouble. That's what he's saying. But if ye worship not, ye shall be cast the same hour into the midst of a burning fiery furnace. And who is that God that shall deliver you out of my hands? He's again wanting to propose a test between the God of the Jews and the gods of Babylon. God's going to take him up. He's going to take him up at that proposal. And so now he said, if you'll worship when the orchestra plays, then fine. But if you don't, then I'm going to have some men to pick you up by the nape of the neck and throw you right over in that furnace, and you're going to burn. You're going to burn in the fire. I can imagine as he's telling them that the flames are rising up out of that furnace, heated good and hot. Probably they know all about the furnace. They've looked at it. I've often wondered, what about these other people that came from Judea? They evidently bowed down, didn't they? Yeah, a lot of them claimed to believe in Jehovah, claimed to believe in the God of Israel. They're out there bowing down before this image, this idol God. Just three fellows, though, had stiff backs. And so he has proposed a second chance. He said, I don't know about this. If it's so, too bad, then you're going to be in trouble. But now he does not upbraid them for not showing respect to him, because he knows that they have. It's not a question of their loyalty. It's a question of whether or not they're going to worship the gods of Babylon. And so that's what he's after them about now. He said, if it's true or untrue, I'm going to decide right now for myself. And he said, if you disobey, then there's not anybody going to be able to save you from the punishment that I'll mete out. A little practical point here. If the king had the right politically to throw people into the fiery furnace that didn't worship his image, is God not more justified in casting people into hell that will not worship him? Think about that for a few moments. He certainly is. You say, well, how did it turn out? Well, we won't get to the end of the lesson how it really turned out, but we're going to see one thing. That is, we're going to see that some fellows wouldn't compromise. You know, there's an old saying that every man has his price. And a lot of times I've seen people have a price offered and they accepted it. I've known men to give up a lot of things that they ought not to give up because they did have a price. Judas had a price for selling out the Lord. Evidently, these other Judeans that are here, they had a price and they said, my life's worth more than my religion. And so if I don't live, I can't serve God, so I believe I'll bow down before the image. Three men, though, wouldn't compromise, wasn't any way to get them to do what they were told to do. And it was the law of the land. Now, are we always to obey the law of the land? No. When it's contrary to the law of God, we obey God rather than man. That's taught in Acts chapter 5, verse 29. So, right now, we have a law that says we are not to read the Bible or to pray in public schools. That is, the Supreme Court has so ruled that that's what it means. I don't think that's what it means at all, but that's the present ruling back in 1963 when we had that. So now what should our attitude be toward this law that is anti-God, anti-Christ, anti-Holy Spirit? Pay no attention to it. So, well, it's the law of the land. Doesn't make any difference. The law of God's greater than the law of man. I saw a little cartoon one day, and it brought almost tears to my eyes as I thought about the possibility someday it might be so. A little boy was sitting outside the door, you know, said principal's office up over the door. One of them told the other one, he said, well, said I threw a magazine, hit a boy in the back of the head, and said the teacher sent me down to the office. Said, what are you down here for? I said, they caught me praying. Now, I know it was intended as a joke, but really it's not very funny when you think about it. Very serious. Can you imagine that the time might come in our public school systems here at South Point or Ashland or some other place when one of our children would be in the office of the principal because he was caught with the Bible, he was caught praying in school? It's possible. It's very possible. And what should we do if we face that? Go right on serving God. Pay no attention to the law of man. Because the law of God is far greater than the law of any man. If men want their laws to be obeyed, then they'd better have respect to the law of God. Otherwise, Christians are not obligated to obey these ordinances of men. So you say, well, should a fellow take his Bible to school? Yes. Should he pray if he wants to? Yes. Whatever the consequence, don't pay any attention to the law of the land when it's contrary to the law of God. You know what's so funny and ridiculous about this law is that the teacher can stand up in the class and teach against God, teach evolution, all this. Nothing's wrong with that. They can teach communism. They can teach socialism. They can teach Nazism and all the rest of them. There's nothing wrong with that, but if you say anything about God, you're in trouble, see. Well, now we know who got that law passed. The devil did. You can talk about the lady down in Texas and talk about the American Civil Liberty Union and all these other things, but really it was the devil got that law passed, just like he got this law passed here. We just well to call it what it is. It's of the devil. It's not of God. What is so ridiculous about it is that our Constitution says Congress shall make no law prohibiting the free exercise of religion. What have they done, though, in that ruling? They've done exactly what the Constitution says they cannot do. So they're in opposition even to the law of our own country. And that very definitely ought to be changed. It is wrong. It is wrong. The 1963 ruling of the Supreme Court is wrong. Now, they tried to say to justify themselves that the idea was that we didn't want the state to establish religion. Well, I agree with that. I don't believe you can establish religion by the state. But they forgot about the part that says, nor prohibit the free exercise thereof. They prohibited Bible reading and prayer in that ruling, which is certainly contrary to our own law here in this country. So let men make whatever laws they want to. Our duty is always to God first and to country second. If it must need so require, it ought to be that we could be good Christians and good citizens. If we can't, then we're to be good Christians anyway. Now let's look at these defiant Jews in verse 16 to 18, and I must move along quickly here. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king. They didn't hesitate. Didn't have to study about it. Didn't have to confer with one another. O Nebuchadnezzar, we are not careful to answer thee in this matter. They said, there's no decision to it. Said, our mind's already made up. What do you mean? Got to have time to deliberate. We've already deliberated a long time ago when we became followers of Jehovah. If it be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace. Now, they believed their God could do it. They wasn't sure he was going to, but they said he can if he wants to. And he will deliver us out of thine hand, O king. He just said nobody could. They said our God can if he wants to. They disputed the word of the king. But if not... In other words, it's not God's providential purpose to save us from the furnace. They didn't know what God's will for them was. They didn't care. They were going to do his revealed will no matter what happened. But if not, be it known unto thee, O king, that we will not serve thy gods, nor worship the golden image which thou hast set up. So it doesn't make any difference how many times the orchestra plays. Doesn't make any difference how many times you set up an image. We're never going to worship that image, nor will we worship the gods of Babylon. Well, they had a lot of courage, didn't they? They were not afraid to state their religious convictions. Are you? Would you state them before the President of the United States? They were not uncertain about God's ability to deliver them, but they were unsure as to what his purpose might be. They assured the king that their God was able to deliver them. They had faith in their God, didn't they? They recognized that God's will could sometimes be unpleasant, maybe to burn in the furnace. But they did not make their obedience contingent upon God doing anything for them. They said, if God delivers us, we'll be delivered. If he doesn't deliver us, we'll do what he said. Doesn't make any difference. Well, I think that's an important thing because the object of their affection was God himself and not in what God could do for them. You know, some people say, Lord, if you'll do this for me, I'll do this for you. Don't proposition God. He doesn't take propositions. He'll tell you how it's going to be, and that's all of it. Well, these boys had the right idea about it. Have you thought about how they could have reasoned and what they could have said if they went according to the modern standards of the world today? They could have said, now look, it's useless to resist. If we don't do what the king said, we're going to get killed. After all, a lot of other people from Judea, a lot of other people like us, they're doing it. What's wrong with us doing it too? But they didn't reason that way, did they? Then they could have said, well, after all, civil duty demands it. After all, it's the law of the land, and we're citizens of this kingdom now. We're going to have to do what the king said. Well, we got to obey the law of the land. Haven't you heard Christians say that? Sometimes when it's contrary to the law of God. Well, they could have reasoned like this, and well, after all, I believe we can do more good for God by living than we can by dying. So after all, there are a lot of other Judeans here, and if we get ourselves killed and we lose these positions in the kingdom, we won't be able to help them, you know. We won't be able to do anything for them, so we better go on and live. After all, a live coward's better than a dead hero. You've ever heard that? Well, they could have reasoned like that. They could have reasoned like some do. It'd be better to be red than dead. I've heard that slogan a few years back. Still sometimes today. Well, I'd rather be dead than red. I'll turn it around. I'm like Patrick Henry. I'd rather have liberty or to have death. I shall have one or the other. I do not want to be red. Have no desire to go in that direction. Now, they could have said, well, after all, this is an awful lot to ask. You know, a fellow would get burned in the furnace. That thing's hot over there. Look at it. We don't want to get in that thing. That's too much. After all, I'd rather give up a little of what I believe, compromise a little, than to give up my life. But they didn't reason that way. They said, we'll give up our life, we won't give up our faith. So what we need today is some people that would rather give up their life than to give up their faith. So may the Lord help us to be like these three boys. All right, that's all of our lessons.